Here we go, back to Mishle and Modern Psychology. It's been a few weeks. Pesach. Hope everyone had a wonderful Yantif. Today's learning is Le'ilui Nishmas, Robert Torgo, Gary's father. Mirtz Hashem, his neshama shav and aliyah. We are in Pasuk Yud Gimel of Perek Chaf Tes. So 29:13. There's a lot of disagreement or interpretation as to what this pasuk means. Rush the ish techachim nefgashu. A lot of it has to do with the word techachim. Not an easy word to translate, techachim. But some say it's referring to techachim like toch, like inside. So what does that mean, toch, inside? So the word rush, we know. The word rush means poor. Ish techachim, if that means inside, so what is it referring to? So some explain, I think it's the Ralbag, I think I saw. Let me look at it inside. Speaking of inside. So we're in 29:13.
Translation of word, apparently it's dishonest, fraudulent.
Okay, interesting. I don't think I know that one. Let me see the Ralbag inside here. He says, Rash v'ishtachim, hine harash v'hu ha'ani ba'iyun. Ha'ani b'iyun means, anyone know what iyun means? Learning b'iyun. B'iyun means in depth. In depth. So he says, harash hu ha'ani. Rash always means poor. But here, says the Rabbag, we're referring to intellectual poverty. He's a rash in intellect. She'ein etzlo machshava. He doesn't even have the thought process. He kind of mimana el ha'iyun hahu v'hu navuch mipnei zeh bi'iyun. So he's, I don't know how to translate navuch, but he's not getting much out of it because he doesn't have the proper thought capacity, the intellectual capacity. V'ish techachim, however, yesh lo machshavot rabot, makbilot bedrush asher yachkor bo nif. So, Ish techachim, says the Rabbag, is like the word toch. He's like inside. He can like delve into that kind of inside. He can delve into it. So it says, it's really a fascinating read of the pasuk. Rash ve'ish techachim nifgashu. What does the word nifgashu mean? They meet, right? Lifgosh means a pigisha is a meeting or a date, right? Nifgashu means the poor person and the one that can think deeply meet together. What does it mean they meet? You could say complement each other, but the problem with that is that the end of the pasuk is Meir Einei Shnehem Hashem, that Hashem enlightens both of their eyes. Mm-hmm. Meaning the first pasuk means that they're unaware and Hashem makes them aware, right? So whatever this first clause means, it's something negative or at least deficient, that it needs Hashem to enlighten them. Meir Einei. Right, to enlighten their eyes. So, says the Ralbag, Rash v'ish techachim nifgashu, they both meet in the sense that they both have some kind of intellectual deficiency. So how's that possible? The Rash, we said, the Rash was because he's poor in intellect. Okay, but ish techachim, we said, from the word toch, means that they can delve into things. What does that mean? So, says the nifgashu, says the Ralbag, even though the one who can delve into concepts, he has tochichut, right? He can delve into things, even though he thinks he'll be able to understand it. This is so interesting, the way he says this. That the ish techachim, the one who can delve into things, will get so... I don't know if people are familiar with this phrase. I still struggle with it sometimes. But it's paralysis of analysis. You ever heard that phrase?
No.
Paralysis of analysis. It means what it sounds like. That sometimes you so overthink a subject, you can't even come to a conclusion.
Yeah.
You're so in depth. You're so delving into all of the different aspects, the different angles, different ways of looking at something, that you can't make a decision, right? I'm sure people here have been indecisive before, and it's not because you can't think, it's because you're overthinking, right? So says the Ra'abag beautifully, that's what this pasuk means. Rash ve'ish techachim nifkashu. You have the poor intellect and the very high intellect, they meet each other. They both are going nowhere. The poor person is because he can't think straight. And the delving in person, because he thinks too much. Right? So it's a fascinating thing. Like, whether you have a lot of it or you have a little of it, intellect can be, you know, paralyzing. So they are nifkashu. And it comes, they both need Hashem. Meir einei shneihem Hashem. Hashem is the one that will enlighten them. Both the person who doesn't have the capacity to think, and the person is way too involved with all of his analysis, he also will need to be, the truth or the conclusion, the right decision, needs to be revealed to him too, because he's so far gone in that decision process. I had a rabbinic mentor that once said that sometimes we get too bogged down into all the things we're thinking about that we don't even realize that the thing itself is just not worth thinking about. Right? It's just like, we have, you know, sometimes it's not because we have paralysis of analysis. It's because we're trying to think of what to analyze. I'll give you an example. The one he said. The one he said was, you ever go to, the way he said it was, God forbid your wife should ever say to you, go buy toothpaste. Because you go to the toothpaste aisle and you've got all these different things to choose from. You've got the anti-plaque, and you've got the whitening, and you've got, you know, the anti-cavity, and you've got the breath mints, and you've got, you know, all the other gum health and whatever. And he went to this whole comedy routine. You're going to bring the anti-plaque home. Your breath's going to stink, but at least you won't have plaque, right? You'll bring the whitening so everyone can look nice, but everyone's going to get cavities. It's like, you know, Hashem help you if your wife says, go get toothpaste. But in the end of the day, it's a silly decision, right? So the way that he says, he's very, very dramatic, this Rebbe of mine. And he said, imagine when, you know, after 120, you're on your deathbed and your grandchildren are sitting there waiting for their brachas to finally escort you to the next world. You say, sorry, I don't have this half hour to give you brachas because I had to fight plaque. I had to fight against gingivitis. I had to spend a half an hour in the toothpaste aisle making a decision that didn't matter, right? So sometimes we have paralysis over the most silliest things, the little things that don't, but we're so stuck in them. We're so stuck, we're so bogged down in making that decision this way or that way, or gingivitis or plaque or whitening, or right? But sometimes it's not even a worthwhile discussion in the first place, right? And sometimes we feel that. What, Trina?
What about the brand?
What about the what?
The brand of
Oh, the brand. Yeah, don't even get me started with the brand. Yeah. Yeah. What about Pesach? Which one's good for Pesach? Yeah. So either way, so that's what says the Rabbag. Rash v'ish techachim nifgashu. The poor person who can't think, and the ish techachim who can delve into everything and come up with, you know, arguments in both sides for everything, they meet each other. Both of them can't come to a decision because they're both stuck. One because he doesn't know anything, and the other one because he knows too much. Right? They're both stuck trying to make a decision. And in the end of the day, they both need Meir Einei Shneihem Hashem. In the end of the day, the only one that's really going to help is when Hashem just gives them a little nudge. Someone, make the decision for me, Hashem. You know. Well, you go to the toothpaste aisle and the anti-gingivitis is all sold out. Oh, Baruch Hashem, I can just take the other one. And now I'm good to go, you know? Or what they say, the total, right? This one's got everything, you know? If something has everything, so you know it's got nothing, right? It's anti-plaque, and it's whitening, and it's the breath, and it probably has so little of each one of them that you get nothing. Yeah, the 7-in-1, whatever it's called, yeah. You do the best you can. None of them are bad for you. How about that? Well, unless you're a conspiracy theorist, in which case you think that all the toothpaste has sugar in it so that you can go back and get more toothpaste. But that's a different conspiracy for a different time. You can ask the flat earthers about that one. It's the same one that say that they put chemicals in the tissues to give you a cold. All these wonderful conspiracies. But the point is that there's a lot to think about. There's a lot. That's the Ralbag and his understanding of Rash v'ishtechachim nifkashim, that the poor person, poor of intellect, and the person who can delve into it, they meet each other. They both have a paralysis of understanding what to do, but from different directions. There are other explanations of what this means, however. So the Mitzudas David. Mitzudas David explains, Ritzono lomar ben harash me'odo ben hanolar be'osher. Rash, he says, is literal. Literally, the one who is poor because he doesn't have money. Me'odo ben hanolar be'osher v'achar zehuka v'nishbar v'choli ha'oni. But he says Rash is a person who was born poor, born into that situation. And then Ish Techachim, the Ish Techachim, he's not translating the word Techachim to be a derivative as Toch, meaning to delve into, like we saw from the Rabag. But instead he says Techachim means like Haka, Lehakot. Anyone know the word Lehakot?
Wait.
What?
To wait?
Oh, that's Lehakot. Oh. Lehakot, like Hika. Hika means to hit, like the Makos. Same root. It's hard to see it sometimes, but techachim, he says, means to hit. So therefore, what it means here is whether it's the poor person who grew up poor, or it's the rich person who was hit. He's a broken person, and he becomes poor. Nifkashu, they both are in the same place. In the end of the day, they both need help from Hashem. And the reason he says, Ritzon Lomar, the reason he says that Hashem comes along and helps him out. Kaasher yaashir haani o hanolad veosher vehuka becholi haoni. Kaasher yachzur lekadmus so lo b'mikra yavo. Even if the poor person, whether they were born that way or whether they became that way, when they both become rich, which is how he is understanding meir einei shnehem, that both of them are enlightened or they see, you know, the hope, you know, they're brought out of that poverty state. You should know both of them. The poverty and the wealth are both from Hashem. Me'er sh'enei shneihem. Both of them, their poverty and their wealth, are from Hashem. Ki hara v'hatova kol b'gzera v'lo b'mikra. Everything comes from Hashem. Nothing is done by happenstance. Nothing happens by happenstance. There was another thing I wanted to say. Let me see if I can find it here. Yeah. Oh, yes, I like this. This is in a Art Scroll footnote. It's quoting, I don't know who this is, Yitav Panim. I don't know who that is, I apologize. But it says here, homiletically, the pauper, the Rash, is an unlearned but sincerely pious Jew who performs the commandments without understanding but with dedication. He's the Ben Tam. He's the simple son. Mazos, just tell me what to do and I'll do it. He doesn't understand it. The Ish Techachim, as we said before from the Ralbag, is a scholar who understands the Toch. He understands inside. He can delve into it. And significance of the mitzvah, he's the Ben Chacham, right? The one who understands all the details. Both of them illuminate the heavenly realms with their deeds because Hashem appreciates their devotion to the Torah. So what this means is not Meir Einei Shneihem Hashem, that Hashem enlightens both of them. But they, Meir Shnehem, Einei Shnehem, both of them, the way that they see the world, Meir Einei Shnehem, Hashem. They enlighten the world with Hashem. I think that's what he means here. That that both, whether you know a lot or you know a little, you all have, everyone has, the ability to bring Hashem into the world. It's such a beautiful, beautiful message. I think sometimes we think, oh, it's the people that know Torah. They're the ones that are really going to spread the word of Hashem. It's everybody. I think the Lubavitcher Rebbe was famous when a Mashulach asked him, how could I go and become a Shliach in this far off place and bring people closer to Judaism? I feel like I don't know anything. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe says, do you know the letter Aleph? He says, yeah. So teach him the letter Aleph. Teach him the letter Aleph. You know, we all know something. We all have something to share. We all have the mitzvahs that we do. We all have the holidays that we celebrate. And it's a worthwhile reminder. It's a worthwhile reminder. I'm in the middle of now a book from Brené Brown. I've quoted her before, her other books at least. She has a newer book, came out a couple years ago, called The Gifts of Imperfection. It's a little fluffy, but it's a beautiful thesis, which is sometimes we see our imperfections as things that should hold us back until we can fix them. But the truth is, not that they're, you know, gifts like you should share your imperfections, but you have a gift even if it's not perfect, right? Don't let perfect be the enemy of good. You have a lot of good things to share. You might think you are a rush. You might think you are a poor person. You don't have as much knowledge as somebody else, but you can still be Meir and Eishneim. You can still be someone who enlightens the world with the ways of Hashem. So that's Pasuk Yud Gimel. Pasuk Yud Dalid, 29:14. Melech Shofet Be'emes Dalim Kiso La'ad Yikon. This seems like a pretty straightforward pasuk. If a king judges the destitute with truth, meaning justly, so then Kiso La'ad Yikon. So then his chair, his throne, the king's throne, will continue forever. Now there are two ways of understanding this. One way is the rational way. One way is the sort of like scharva onesh way, right? You could say basically that Hashem sees the actions of the king, the righteousness of the king, that he's helping out the poor person or the, what was this? Yeah, the poor person, destitute is a little different than poor, but either way, you know what I mean? He's helping the destitute, the destitute person. And therefore Hashem says, I'll reimburse you. Because of your good deed, because of your righteousness, I will give you a longevity on the throne. Alternatively, you could look at this more rationally. Not that it's some kind of, well, everything is from Hashem, but it's not some kind of supernatural or metaphysical reward that Hashem is providing. Instead, what it means is that Hashem is giving him a structure, or he's gaining for himself a structure that will endure. When a king treats his people justly, so then that means he has a good kingdom. As opposed to taking advantage of the destitute, as opposed to, you know, let them eat cake, you know, as opposed to, you know, being uncaring, unsympathetic, and not worrying about any people that are struggling, if you take care of them and you treat them properly, so then the country will appreciate you. You won't have people overthrowing you. Yesterday, I listened to an entire book throughout the day. It was a book that's much, much longer than the version that I listened to. It was called Team of Rivals. Anyone know the book Team of Rivals? So a pretty well-known book from a, her name is Dara Kearns Goodwin. Famous biographer, or you know, she writes memoirs. And this is all about Abraham Lincoln's cabinet. It's like a 900-page book. I listened to the abridged version. The real version is 41 hours. 41 hours. I've never read a book that, not even close to that. The closest I get, I think The Prime Minister's is a long book. I haven't gone through that yet. But So I only listened to the abridged version. But Lincoln was a fascinating person. I don't just mean because his face is on the penny and because he freed the slaves. I mean in terms of his tactics, in terms of how he went about sort of currying favor with people, he, at least according to this memoir. I mean, I don't. Who of us can really confirm any of this stuff? But through all the diaries and through all the correspondence that we have, he seems like the kind of person that was not willing to take political, you know, corners and, you know, cut the corners. You know, barter, you know, give, you know, buy votes or things like that, which is and was very common. I'll give you this position if you, you know, give me a stump speech, that kind of thing. He seems like he was a very earnest guy, always wanted to sort of, you know, just be buddy-buddy with everyone, you know. And obviously, you know, there was contention. It was a huge civil war under his watch. But the way he went about his business, I wish I could listen to the extended version of just the first third of the book, was all about how his cabinet, I don't know if people know this, his cabinet was made up of all the people that he was running against for the presidency, right? All the people, Seward and Salmon Chase, I'm just trying to remember all the names now. Andrew Bates, like all these people were the people that, you know, he was running against. He never spoke ill of them during the campaigns. They had their own thoughts about him. And then afterwards, he invited them to be part of his cabinet. It's like, it's not unheard of.
You bring your enemies close.
It wasn't really, that's not why. He really thought they were the best people for the job. And while they all sort of, you know, originally demurred because, like, they didn't want to work with the enemy, all of them came to realize sort of the genius of Lincoln and you know, the way that he went about his business and stuff. And obviously there was contention. It's not like, you know, it wasn't all rosy. But the point is, that's Mel Shofet Emes Dalin. Lincoln had a certain way about him that he just cared for people, and the people responded in kind. I was listening later on. It said about the, I guess he was elected in 61, or he took office in 61 or 62. I think the election was in 61. He took office in 62, and then in the next election in 66, 65. I guess the election was in 65. I think those dates are relatively accurate. It's within a few years. If I'm off a little. 18, by the way, 1860, 1860s. So he won overwhelmingly. I think he lost three states, like three out of the whole country. He lost three states because he just he had the favor of all the people, and they were in the middle of a civil war. Right? Imagine how beloved you have to be to win. I know there weren't 50 states, but you know, to how beloved you had to be to only lose, I think it was like New Jersey and California and like one other state that he lost. Right? The Democratic strongholds.
Yeah.
Right? And those were the only ones he lost in the middle of a civil war, which is just crazy. Just crazy that he could win that election so thoroughly. But that just speaks to Melech Shofet Be'emes Dalim Kiso La'ad Yikon. That you can continue with, you can, you know, your throne will endure when you treat people properly. And who knows? I think he was the first in a long time, if I remember. He was the first in a long, I'm not great with presidential history, but I think he was the first in a long time to be reelected. Right? Presidents back then usually would be ousted pretty quickly. I'm sure people here know this history better than I. But he got reelected, which was the first in a long time, which itself spoke to the favor that he had. And if it wasn't for obviously what happened, John Wilkes Booth, so then he would have maybe continued beyond that too. So that's Pasuk Yud Dalet. Shevet v'tochachas yitein chachma. This is one of those that's not going to sound great for the women. Shevet v'tochachas yitein chachma. That the stick and the rebuke will give wisdom. But v'na'ar mishulach mevishimo. A child who is wayward, mishulach, sent off. He will embarrass his mother. He will embarrass his mother. All the Mefarshim try to ask this question, why would he only embarrass his mother? So you could probably think of this. I think we've talked about this in one way or another at different points in Mishlei. But the commentaries all point to the fact that either because of the father's absence or because of the mother's tolerance, the child is going to continue having his difficulties and sort of getting back on the straight and narrow. So, for instance, if it's about the father's absence, so it's going to be blamed on the mother, right? The mother is the one that's going to be mevish, or mitbayeshet. Mm-hmm. Because she's the one that everyone's going to point to and say, oh, he spent all day with mom, and look how he turned out. The father was away on business, right? So this is how he turned out. That's one way of understanding it. Another way of understanding it, some explain, is that it's not that the father was absent, it's that the father tried and the mother protected the kid. And this you see a lot, and it's hard to find this balance. I deal with this, unfortunately, also with people in the shul who are struggling with their kids or who have to discipline their kids or whatever, that the father wants to discipline and the mother wants to take it easy on the kid. It's natural instinct. And I believe that this is why God made man and woman different, so that they can work together to find a healthy balance. Mm-hmm. Too strict of a father is going to be too overbearing. Too sensitive of a mother, or too tolerant of a mother, is going to be too free, right? Too undisciplined. So you need to have that balance. The key to that is to have a father and a mother who can work together. easier said than done. Okay, of course. But the point is that here, what some explain is, if the child goes off the derech, it will be attributed to the mother's own tolerance or the mother's protection of the child, that she didn't allow the child to be disciplined in the way that it was supposed to be. Rashi brings up the case of Yishmael. Yishmael is the one that basically got them kicked out of the house, according to the Medrash. So that's how Rashi explains it. But it's a fascinating insight, at least into back then, to the society back then. But I think it still exists today, that to the extent that we are tolerant of our children's misdeeds, meaning we allow them to go unchecked, undisciplined, that doesn't necessarily mean that they have to be harsh, but to the extent that we don't discipline enough, so then that child will be a reflection of a parent's own lack of discipline. Now, today is a little different than it was back then. Today, the children don't grow up in the home, stay in the home, and, you know, learn in the home, get a trade at the home. Today, you know, children are raised by their peers more than ever. They're raised by, today, social media more than ever. It's a real big challenge for parents today. There's a book coming out, I don't know if it came out or not, from Jonathan Haidt, who wrote recently The Coddling of the American Mind, similar concept. He's coming out with a new book, which I don't remember, it's the Rewiring of America's Youth or something like that. He talks about the effects of social media and technology generally on the youth population, which is no big fiddish, but he goes through a lot of the research, and he is starting, along with the book, he's starting a whole campaign. He's taking it across the country about different things that we as a country should do to limit our children's exposure and thereby their hindrance of growth emotionally, even physically, not going outside and playing them as much, mentally, socially, right, by having technology, right? And he talks about how there's no reason why schools shouldn't ban phones. There's zero reason why children have to have phones in school. You want to say on their way home they need to be able to communicate with their parents? Okay, fine. Why do they need it while they're in the classroom? Like, there's zero reason to have a phone in the classroom. Some say even laptops. You know, that was the debate in my day. The debate was, could a student have a laptop in the classroom?
Well, he uses it for notes.
Yeah, that's what everyone said. You could use it for notes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But at what cost can you say that notes are worthwhile if it comes at the cost of at the expense of all the other distractions that pop up on it? So that's just one thing he talks about. Social media. He talks about collective agreements between parents that at least I think he says a third of the class. David Pelkovitz was ahead of this also, but from YU. That he says at least a third of the class's parents have to all agree no cell phones till they're 16, at all, not just in school. I think it's 16. That might be social media use until 16. But he says the reason why kids are getting their phones earlier and earlier is because they keep saying so and so's got a phone. Everyone's got a phone. And he says, if at least a third of the class doesn't have a phone, then the parents can say, yeah, but not everyone has a phone. What about so-and-so? In Jewish schools, it's not as bad, but it's still bad. And so that's his big thing. So to the same extent where, despite the fact that today there are so many more influences on a child's life and upbringing than ever before, and maybe it won't be attributed as much to the parent as it once was, right? When the parent raised the child in the home all the time. Today, there are things that can be attributed to parents. How early you give a child technology is directly attributable to parents. It might be difficult. It might require the mother to be less tolerant of what the child wants, right? And the child's kicking and screaming, I want a phone, I want an iPad, I want whatever, insert social media thing here, right? The mother's going to have to hold herself back and say, yeah, they shouldn't have it till later. They can't have it now. So that is attributable to the parents. So while maybe the social reality has changed, and the upbringing of a child has changed, there are definitely things that can be embarrassing to parents. Embarrassing to parents in the upbringing. And that's what it says. V'na'ar mishulach, if a child goes off, so that could also still, mevish ima, it can still be an embarrassment to the mother, which is sort of really just a placeholder for any parent that's tolerant of their wayward ways. Birvos rishaim yirbe pasha. With the, I don't know how to say, birvos is actually debated. Birvos could either mean, this by the way is also part debated in the Haggadah. Revava ketzamach hasad is one of the drushes in the Haggadah. The word birvos, the increase, could either mean the influence or the quantity. Right? Does it mean that there are more and more rishaim, evil, wicked people around? Or does it mean with the greater power of the rushes that exist? Birvos rishaim yirba pasha. When they gain power or when they gain numbers, naturally it will influence the environment. So the Rambam says, if a person is having difficulty because of their environment, so move. Go somewhere else. Right? Yigla l'makom Torah, which is also, I believe, in the Pirkei Avos coming up, that you know, you give me all the money in the world, I won't go anywhere without a place that has Torah. So that's what it means, Birvos Hashem, Yirba Pasha. It's just a matter of time until more and more sinning occurs when you are being ruled or influenced so strongly, increasingly strongly, by surrounding rishaim, surrounding wicked evildoers. However, but tzaddikim, when it comes to the righteous people in that place, truly righteous people, the mapaltam yiru, they will watch their downfall. They will watch their downfall, which is an interesting phrase. I'm not 100% sure whether this means v'tzadikim, if there's a preponderance of tzaddikim, meaning relative to the rishaim, or in the opposite direction of the rishaim, if there's a greater increase of tzaddikim, so then they'll watch the downfall of the rishaim, meaning it's just a numbers game. Do we have more righteous people, or do we have more sinful people? And if there are more righteous, if there are more sinful people, so then the society will just have more sin. As opposed to if it's tzaddikim, if there's a groundswell of more righteous people, so then b'mal pal tam yiru, they will be able to watch not the influence of the evildoers, but the downfall of the evildoers. So that's one way of understanding this. Or you could say,
but we know that when the evildoers increase, by the time the righteous
see their downfall, that's the question.
There's a lot of righteous people who lose their lives.
So two things on that. First of all, you're interpreting this as a continuum, which is the other way of saying I was about to say, which is that this is happening in the same place. There's a increase of evildoers, and then therefore an increase of sinning. And then the tzaddikim, who are there in that evil place, will watch their downfall. Eventually they will be able to outlive them, whether just literally or figuratively. The tzaddikim will endure and the rishayim will ultimately perish one way or another. So that's one way of understanding it. And to your second point, which is that who knows how many tzaddikim will perish, I think that's exactly the point of the pasuk, which is those who will give in to the sin are not really tzaddikim. That's a harsh reality, but I think that's what he's saying. The ones that will be able to be bimapal tam yiru, the ones that will be able to witness their downfall, are the ones that are truly tzaddikim, that didn't give in to the influence of the rishayim. So I don't think that's an easy read, but I think that's a way you could read it. It is interesting to see yiru. Yiru is just to watch. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what the connotation of watching is. You're watching from like the sideline, as if to say maybe they sort of remove themselves from the equation, as opposed to the rishayim who are in the city, having the influence, they're watching from afar. Maybe that's the imagery they were supposed to get, that they're not even involved. Whereas it doesn't say that tzaddikim will avoid them. It says they'll watch them from afar. It's an interesting phrase. Alternatively, and this is a little more dramatic, you could say that b'rivos rishayim yir bel pesha means that the rishayim are really having their influence. So much so that it's not even worth the tzaddikim trying. Right, that they are increasing so much sin that tzaddikim are not going to get involved. And what Shlomo Melech is saying, tzaddikim b'mabaltam yiru, as meaning like as a directive, just watch their downfall. at a certain point, you can't help somebody. At a certain point, they're so far gone, it's not worth the risk of trying to help them along. So maybe Shlomo, and this is, again, more dramatic, but maybe Shlomo Melech is saying, Tzadikim b'ma patam yiru. Just watch as they go, as they have their downfall. Don't try to get involved when there's so much evil, there's so much sin. Take care of yourself. Right? Someone reminded me today of a wonderful quote, at least attributed to Reb Simcha Banu Mepshischa, that, I don't know if I ever told this story. I was once asked to give a, what's the difference between invocation and convocation? I don't know the difference. I was once asked to speak before some kind of, it was a political outing, which I was a little uncomfortable with. I wasn't the rabbi of a shul at the time. And I would do it for any person. It was right after the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting. Yeah. You remember that attack? And they wanted to have a rabbi speak. Oh, invocation at a convocation, is that right? Interesting. Okay, I'll have to brush up on that vocabulary. So you don't give a convocation? I guess that makes sense. Okay. An invocation is done at a convocation. Got it. So either way, so I was asked to speak. And I basically said to the crowd, you know, a difficult time to the Jewish people, etc. And I said to them, it's very hard for us to think, what can we do? You know, what can we do to stem the tide of these radicals doing these radical, unfortunate things, you know? I think some people are thinking of that now, right? And I quoted them this adage from Reb Simcha Banu Mepshischa, who said apparently that when he was younger, I don't know what age, that when he was younger, he thought he was going to change the world. And then when he tried to change the world, it didn't work. So he tried to change his country. He tried to change it, didn't work. Then he tried to change his city. Not even the city. Then he tried to change his neighborhood. Couldn't change the neighborhood. He tried to change his own family. He couldn't change people in his family until he realized the only thing he can change is himself. But then, once he changed himself, he noticed that his family was changing and that his neighborhood was changing and that his city was changing. And ultimately, if you change yourself, you can really change the world. That was his shtickle. I think there are two ways of interpreting that phrase, and I've never really seen it inside from the Hebrew of Reb Simcha Banu. I've only ever seen it quoted, and it never really does justice to these two interpretations. But whenever he elucidates the two possible ways of interpreting it, I think you could either say that his perspective shifted, meaning it wasn't that he actually changed the world, but he started looking at the world differently when he changed himself. I think that's one way to read it. Or you could say, as I think a lot of people interpret it, which is that when he changed his attitude, he had a much greater influence on other people. When he stopped trying to change others and instead he focused on himself, he had a much greater influence on other people. So that's what I had said at this convocation, in my invocation. I had said that we can't necessarily change these radicals, but we can, in all of our own ways, make the world a nicer place, a more kinder place. That means the bus driver, that means our neighbors, that means our friends. And so that's what I said. And I think a little bit here, the tzaddikim b'ma paltam yiru, the righteous people, work on yourself. If when it comes to the rishayim, just watch from afar. If you work on yourself, this again, more drush, but if you work on yourself, who knows how that can spill over to other people. But trying to get involved with real rishayim, when they have so many numbers, it's a fool's errand. So I think maybe that's a drasha, but something you could see. And sort of lastly, in this section from Shlomo Melech, and lastly for us tonight, Yaser bincha v'yinichecha. The Mesudas of it explains, v'yinichecha means it will give you rest. If you disciplined your child, like we were saying before, if you discipline your child, it will give you rest. What does it mean, it will give you rest? I think he's alluding to the fact that it's very difficult to discipline a child. Yeah. Not because it's hard to get them to do what you want, but it's hard to see them struggle with your discipline.
It goes back to your
right. It's hard, right? It's hard to say no phones to a child who's clamoring for a phone, mm-hmm. who thinks in their mind it's like the most important thing they need. Right? And just like a parent has to hold down a child to get medical treatments because they know that's what's right for them, but the child doesn't understand it, so too disciplining a child is difficult. And the child doesn't understand it. I've quoted before from David Palkovitz, how he says that all the children of parents who refused to give them phones in high school, later on, all those children thanked their parents. At the moment, they were, you know, saying other kinds of words at their parents, but afterwards, they really appreciated it and how they had a real, a much better upbringing, you know, a more wholesome social connection to their friends and a wholesome, you know, physical activity and study habits. Now, all the things that go along with not having technology. But in the moment, it's very difficult for a parent. So I think Shlomo Melech is saying that when he uses this word, v'nichecha, according to the Mitzvah David, you will have menucha. You don't have it right now. It is not a restful experience to discipline a child and to prohibit them from what they really, really want. It is difficult. It is stressful. It is anxiety-ridden to not be able to soothe your child, to comfort your child, to cause the pain to a child. But Shlomo Melech is saying, v'nichecha. Ultimately, you will have menucha. You will notice how this child develops more properly. And that's when you'll have... Better to have menucha then than to have menucha now by giving in to whatever they want. Right? Better, you know, in just a silly analogy, better to have menucha when their teeth are still intact, going back to the toothpaste analogy, than to allow them to have all the candy and have to bring them to the dentist all the time. That's on my mind because my kids just went to the dentist today. And this is the one day, every 6 months my kids get excited about, you know, brushing their teeth. Yeah. It's the day they go to the dentist. They get their new toothpaste and their new whatever. Yeah. So that was today. I didn't get to witness it. I was here. But either way, better to force the discipline on the child who doesn't like it and be uncomfortable right now so that you can rest easy later. When that child has hopefully developed into a better person because of it. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, that child, as he grows up into an adult, in Mirtz Hashem, that child will give you ma'adanim, not just give you rest, but he will give you pleasure. She will give you nachas and pride in all the things that she does or all the things that he's able to accomplish, all the things they can literally give you and all the things that make you proud. Right? And that discipline is hard. It's hard. It's difficult as a parent to see your child be pained because of you. But it'll all pay off. It'll all pay off. You'll feel the rest later. And Amir Hashem, you'll get that pride later because ultimately that child has grown into the person you were ever always hoping them to be. Mm-hmm. Easier said than done, of course. Yeah. But the point is, you sacrifice the now for the sake of the later. And Amir Hashem, we should all be zochat. To see whether it's children, colleagues, or students that we have to discipline one way or another, we should see them take our lessons to heart, even if it's difficult in the moment, and be able to enjoy the pride that we have in them later as they grow into the people that we hope for them to be. Okay. Right. Everyone should have a wonderful, wonderful night, a week.
I have a couple of questions. Do you have time?
Yeah,